You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Leanne Morose. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, June 25th, 2018.
It just so happened to be that building was an after-hours haven of jazz musicians and some classical musicians as well. Some people like Thelonious Monk, Chick Corea, Steve Reich, the classical composer.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Michael Glab speaks with Sam Stevenson about his book on the work of Gene Smith. Smith was a New York City photographer who happened to rent a loft next to a jazz studio used by some of the biggest names in jazz. That's coming up on today's edition of Big Talk Extra with Michael Glab.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Molly Wagshaw has been volunteering every Monday to tutor children at the Monroe County Public Library's El Centro Comunal Latino Outreach Program. We'll hear more about El Centro later in the program on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, your daily headlines.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb declared last week as Immigrant Heritage Week at a press conference today. As WFHB correspondent Francis Sheets reports, the move comes after President Donald Trump signed an executive order that would roll back family separations last week.
In a press release sent out today, Governor Holcomb declared last week as Immigrant Heritage Week. The retrospective declaration of a week dedicated to immigrants' rights comes after pressure from the Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance and the American Friends Service Committee. Governor Holcomb's signed proclamation states, quote, immigrants have provided the United States with unique and cultural influence, fundamentally enriching the extraordinary nature of our nation, unquote. At a press conference at the Indiana State House today, representatives from Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance praised Holcomb for the declaration of Immigrant Heritage Week. In the past, the state of Indiana has passed laws limiting the resettlement of refugees and the entrance of immigrants into the state. In 2011, the Indiana General Assembly enacted a bill which included mandatory English-only documentation and allowed law enforcement to racially profile suspects. The bill was one of 16 companion bills to Arizona's highly controversial 1070 Senate bill. That bill was the broadest and strictest anti-illegal immigration bill to ever be passed in Arizona and garnered national attention. According to a press release from the Quaker-affiliated American Friends Service Committee, quote, Indiana's legislative history is a representation of how unwelcoming and harmful the state can be. It goes on to read, quote, despite legislation, or lack thereof, immigrant communities have thrived, unquote. According to recent polling by the Indiana Institute for Working Families, the number of refugees resettled in Indianapolis dropped drastically last year. Governor Holcomb, who served as Mike Pence's lieutenant governor in 2016, was sworn in as governor of Indiana in January of 2017. The year prior, more than 2,000 refugees were resettled in the Indianapolis area. That number dropped to just over 600 last year, a 69% decrease. Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance praised Holcomb for taking, quote, the right step forward in today's declaration of Immigrant Heritage Week, last week. For WFHB, I'm Francis Sheets.
Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson was meant to be on Capitol Hill last week. As WFHB correspondent Jonah Chester reports, Lawson sent statements to federal lawmakers asking them to bolster election security throughout the country.
Indiana will receive $7.1 million from the federal government to help improve its election security. The funding is part of a $380 million one-time grant being given out to local elections offices across the country. The grant, which is distributed through the Federal Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, will be used to boost cybersecurity efforts and replace aging voting infrastructure throughout the state. In a written statement submitted to the U.S. Senate's Committee on Rules and Administration yesterday, Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson explained that the new security measures should be fully rolled out by the 2020 presidential elections. Lawson is the top elections official in the state and is charged with protecting voter security. Valerie Warcha, communications director for Secretary Lawson's office, says that the $7.1 million infusion is a small cut of the amount states were given for improving election security after the 2000 presidential election. HAVA was originally created after the Bush v. Gore elections case to ensure that voter security and operations were improved upon.
Just to give you an idea, this is the rest of the Help America Vote Act funds that states were promised in the 2000s after the hanging chads. And back then, Indiana got $71 million, and that was used to buy new election equipment statewide. This time we're getting roughly 10% of that. We're getting $7.1 million, and the goal is to help with cybersecurity. That's why the federal government gave us this money.
One of the measures being considered by the Secretary of State's office to improve security for voter registration info involves a sensor that keeps a detailed list of who views voter registration and ID information. Lawson wrote to the U.S. Senate that she is also considering a dual authentication process to further limit who can access voter rolls.
Currently, we're looking at two-factor authentication. It's something that was recommended by the FBI. And what I mean by this is counties have access to the statewide voter registration system. This is one of the few things that's on the internet when it comes to elections. And so besides just using a username and a password, there's a token or some other device to help make sure that you are who you say you are before you access the statewide voter registration system. In Indiana, we've already started a pilot of that with 10 counties. We're looking at expanding that statewide.
Indiana has had its own recent issues with election security. Earlier this year, Lawson's office revealed that Russian actors had tested the state's digital voter rolls for weaknesses during the 2016 presidential elections. According to the Indiana Secretary of State's office, no votes were changed, but Lawson did confirm that private voter data had been stolen. For WFHB, I'm Jonah Chester.
According to the May Indiana Unemployment Report, Owen, Greene, and Monroe counties boast some of the highest unemployment rates in the state. The May Indiana Unemployment Report was released by the Indiana Department of Workforce Development last week. The report showed that overall, Indiana's unemployment rate is relatively low at 3.2%, particularly when compared to the national average of 3.8%. Indiana's unemployment rate by county, however, tells a much different story. 40 of the state's 92 counties have a higher unemployment rate than the state average. Of the 40 county rates that sit above the state rate, 9 counties have a higher unemployment rate than the national average. Owen and Greene counties both fall into that category at a shared unemployment rate of 4%. They tie for fifth in the state for unemployment. Only around 9,000 Owen County residents fit the criteria to be considered part of the labor force. To be considered part of the labor force, an individual must have actively sought work in the past 4 weeks or been temporarily laid off from their last job. Only around 9,000 in Owen County fit this criteria, and approximately 400 of those individuals fall into the unemployed category. Greene County is in a similar situation. Greene County only has a slightly larger labor force than Owen County. Just over 13,000 Greene County residents meet the criteria to be considered part of the labor force, and more than 600 of these individuals are unemployed. This puts Greene County at fifth in the state, along with Owen County. While Monroe County does not rank quite as high as Greene and Owen counties, it does boast a higher unemployment rate than the state average. Monroe County comes in at 12th in the state for unemployment with a rate of 3.7%, which is higher than the statewide 3.2%. Monroe County's unemployment rate falls just below the national average of 3.8%. This number has even gone down in recent years, falling from 4.4% in August of 2017. The same goes for Owen and Greene counties. This trend, at least in Monroe County, correlates to the fluctuating population in Bloomington throughout the year. According to Alex Crowley, the director on the Bloomington Department of Economic and Sustainable Development, unemployment rates in Monroe County often spike during the summer. When IU students leave, there is less of a need for certain services through the city, leading to employees being laid off in May. While there are certainly other nuances within this trend, Crowley says Monroe County's rate will likely go back down when students return to town in August.
Monroe County is beginning a multi-phase project to update the county's security systems. Chief Technology Officer Eric Evans says the first phase sets the basic infrastructure, starting with county's new parking garage. Evans described the project to Monroe County Commissioners on last week.
So with this first phase, what we're going to be doing is adding some swipe card locks to the pedestrian doors of the parking garage. And then we are also going to be purchasing a video server that is going to be used as we expand the security system throughout the county. The server itself is modular, so as the county grows and their data needs become more intense, we can add resources to that.
Evans said security cameras will be installed in the garage in a second phase.
Again, both of these are to create a safer environment for the county employees. The parking garage, sometimes you get some unsavory characters lurking about in the parking garage.
Commissioners approved two agreements with security automation systems to buy, install, and program new equipment and provide training. The two agreements total $86,000. Evans told Commissioner Amanda Barge he expects the project will be well underway by next month.
I'm hopeful that there can be some overlap in the projects because the vendor that's doing the server installation is not the same vendor that's doing the conduit for the video capture devices. So I'm hopeful that it'll be well underway in about 3 to 4 weeks.
In a traffic update, Public Works Director Lisa Ridge reported the 2nd Street Bridge project will not be finished before the Monroe County Fair starts. Officials previously expected the project would be done by the time the fair opens on Saturday, June 30th.
It's not going to be completely done. However, they are going to open it up to 4 lanes with the temporary striping. So they will be doing no work there for the 2 weeks, the week prior to the fair and the week of the fair. So that way they don't want to, interact with all the fair traffic.
Ridge says the current new completion date for that project is August. The next meeting of the Monroe County Commissioners is scheduled for Wednesday.
Monroe County is one step closer to building a connector road between North Daniels Way and Hart Street Road. Public Works Director Lisa Ridge reported on the project to the Monroe County Redevelopment Commission on June 20th. She said the county has obtained the last right-of-way parcel it needs for the project.
The papers have been signed, and we're just waiting for the bank to release the mortgage. So all the parcels have been obtained for the Hart Street Road project.
Ridge said the full right-of-way acquisition process took longer than expected. She said the next step is to request for bids for the road's construction. Commission Chairman Barry Lesso asked Ridge for a timeline.
It's June. Everything takes time, so I'm gonna guess it's gonna be a main construction year of 2019 to be realistic. Weather depending, you might be able to get some things started. One good thing is you're not closing traffic. Those are things that you can get around. So,
with area contractors busy with the many current road projects, Ridge said bids could be quite high for new 2018 construction. She said delaying construction to 2019 could mean lower quotes on road construction. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Benedict Jones.
And I'm Leanne Moroz. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington. Sam Stevenson ran across the groundbreaking works of photo essayist Gene Smith a few years ago. Stevenson says he became obsessed with Smith's photos and the thousands of hours of audio tapes Smith recorded while living in a loft in New York City's Market District from the mid-1950s through the 60s. By chance, Smith had moved next door to another loft where some of America's biggest names in jazz gathered nightly to practice. Stevenson eventually published The Jazz Loft Project, a book and traveling exhibition of Smith's work in New York. Stevenson last year released a second book called Gene Smith's Sink. Stevenson joined host Michael Glab on last week's Big Talk. Here's a recap of that show on this week's Big Talk Extra.
Hi, this is Big Talk. Michael Glab here. My guest this week in the studio, author, jazz maven, Sam Stevenson. Sam, thanks for being on Big Talk.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much.
Sam, your life, to a large extent, has been devoted to this fellow, Gene Smith. Who's Gene Smith?
Well, he made his name as a combat photographer in World War II. And then he went on to be a Life magazine photo essayist. If you Googled him, you'd often see the phrase, the master of the photographic essay or the father of the photographic essay. He was a pioneer in creating visual stories, which back before television was the primary way that people received their imagery were in weekly or monthly magazine stories. And Life magazine, of course, was the powerhouse of that model.
I've looked at some of his images, and he's got that gritty, stark kind of photography that it wasn't perfumed. It didn't pull any punches.
He called himself a photojournalist from until he died. And I believe he was kind of riddled by this tension between journalism and art. Huh. And so he was always looking for gritty things. And sometimes if they weren't there, he would insert them into the picture.
How did you get interested in this fellow?
Well, it started in 1997. I was fascinated by the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and was interested in writing my own book on Pittsburgh. And I stumbled upon a reference to Eugene Smith's unfinished Pittsburgh project from the 1950s. To make a long story short, Smith went to Pittsburgh in 1955 for a three-week assignment and ended up staying for 4 years and made 22,000 photos in the city. And he never finished the project. So what I did was I tried to pick up the pieces of his failed Pittsburgh project. So my first project was a little, what I thought was a fairly benign magazine article about Smith's Pittsburgh project. It's for a magazine called Double Take. And here I am today, 20 years later, more than 20 years later, and I'm just finishing all of that work. In 1955, he quit Life magazine, where he had been highly successful for more than a decade. He gave all of that up because he was not happy with the artistic limitations that he felt at the magazine. He felt like the editors were not giving him enough artistic freedom. He had a wife and four kids living out in Croton on Hudson. Mm-hmm. They had a really big house, and he was having trouble finishing the Pittsburgh project. It's just the ambitions kept going up and up and up, and it just was impossible. And he was also addicted to alcohol and addicted to amphetamines, and so these kind of cycles of highs and lows. He was also probably almost certainly bipolar. So he had these cycles of 5 days without sleeping, just working, and then he would crash. And it just was a way of life that wasn't conducive to being in a family home. So he left in 1957 and moved into this dilapidated building on 6th Avenue and 28th Street in New York City. And it just so happened to be that building was an after-hours haven of jazz musicians. Uh-huh. And hundreds of jazz musicians and some classical musicians as well.
Really well-known guys.
Yeah, some people like Thelonious Monk, Chick Corea, Steve Reich, the classical composer, went there, as well as very obscure figures as well. It was a perfect habitat for him. The musicians were all there to jam.
You discovered about 40,000 photographic images. You found about 1,700 hours of tapes, audio tapes.
I was working on the Pittsburgh project when I found in the back of his photography archive at the University of Arizona these boxes full of tapes, reel-to-reel tapes, and they'd been in the same boxes since the archive was created back in the 1970s. And I started picking through them on one of my trips out there, and I just noticed these names like Thelonious Monk on there and others, Zoot Sims and Bill Evans and other names, Art Farmer. And so I just became curious about those tapes, and no one had ever heard them before because the University of Arizona had the rightful policy that the tapes needed to be properly preserved before they were played back.
Because running them through a machine could degrade them.
Could damage them, yeah. And that was the right policy. But it made it daunting because it meant we had to raise a lot of money to preserve those tapes before we could listen to them. He had the building wired from the sidewalk up to the fifth floor. He wired the stairwell. He wired the fire escape. I mean, he was recording great jazz jam sessions, but he was also recording street noise, people walking up and down the stairs, things off radio and TV, random conversations.
In a sense, he lost his mind?
Well, you'd have to say that if someone did that now, you know, that you knew in your neighborhood, that you'd probably reach that conclusion. So in addition to photographing the jazz musicians inside the building, he exposed an equal number of negatives through the window of life in the neighborhood. And again, that's just really invaluable because he documented that corner from that one vantage point in a way I often said he was like a biologist studying a half acre, you know, of forest. So I got really lucky. In 1999, I published an article about this building in New York City in Double Take magazine, but I had not heard the tapes because they still needed to be preserved. So I wrote an article about it. It was covered on CBS Sunday Morning. I was on that show. And in Chicago on that Sunday morning, there was a wealthy man named David Logan on his, he said later, he was on his treadmill watching CBS Sunday Morning as he did every Sunday. And there was this story about my article with me. And so he went and found the magazine, read it. And then a few weeks later, I get this call out of the blue. And David Logan said, you know, I read your article. I saw your spot on TV. What can we do to help?
Sam Stevenson, the author of Gene Smith's Sink, a brand new book out in the bookstores now. Sam, thank you for being on Big Talk.
Thank you, Michael. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That was Sam Stevenson speaking with Big Talk's Michael Glab. Full episodes of Big Talk air on Thursdays at 5:30 p.m. right here on WFHB.
Support for WFHB comes from Lorne Wood Builders. Lorne Wood Builders is a family-owned company that sources local materials and local craftsmen to minimize environmental impact and sustain community. More information is available online at lornewoodbuilders.com.
Now it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference, volunteer.
Hi, my name is Molly Wagshall and I volunteer with El Centro. I'm a senior at Bloomington High School South. I spent a semester in Spain when I was a sophomore in high school, and so I learned a lot of Spanish and I wanted to put it to use when I got back to the United States. And I was like, oh, well, maybe I could do some volunteering because that would be like a productive way to practice my Spanish too. And so I started writing for El Boletín Comunitario, which is run by the City of Bloomington Latino Outreach Programs. And it was really good. And then the director at the time, she introduced me to Jane Walter at El Centro. And then I started volunteering there, doing the tutoring, doing the Operation Fit Kids summer camp. I've definitely never really thought about how large like Bloomington's Latino population is and how it's really growing. And because before I sort of like I would meet some people who were like immigrants, but also, but just like not very often in my daily life because everyone has their own little bubble. But being there and like volunteering with El Centro, there's like a lot of new immigrants, and it can be, I guess, difficult because there's a lot of rhetoric that's directed against immigrants, especially from Latin America. So I think it's very important to include everyone in our community and help them adjust in the ways that we can. I think that El Centro has like a really great mission with helping the Latino community, because I think oftentimes there are not so many organizations that help, especially with children who are heritage speakers. A heritage speaker is someone who has grown up speaking Spanish with their family. The language that they speak at home is different from the language that they speak at school. So basically they've learned how to speak Spanish, but not necessarily to write like in school. What I've realized a lot from volunteering with tutoring children who like don't speak English at home usually is that people who speak English at home definitely have an advantage. Like myself, I always like, my parents would always like read to me in English, and like if there was an assignment that was like written in English, like read to your children for 20 minutes or something, then they could just help me. But for a lot of people who are like new immigrants who speak Spanish, it can be very difficult just to do sort of like what we would think as like a simple assignment. This really warms my heart too. Sometimes when the parents come to pick their kids up after tutoring, they'll be like, thank you for helping my child. And I guess it's very nice to see, because like they're like, so they really want to help their children, and they do so much to help them, and they're like great parents. But like sometimes there are things that are just like, there's a language barrier that just prevents them from fulfilling that sort of step. And then it is really easy for someone who speaks English to just be like, oh yeah, this is like the translation of this homework assignment, and then they can help their kids, you know? I like to think that I've helped each individual kid who I've tutored at El Centro. And I mean, I'm not like a education specialist or anything, but just like, it does make me feel, sort of like I've made a small difference when a kid has made a breakthrough on reading or something, or is like having less trouble with their homework and stuff, or like more willing to ask a question. I guess I would encourage anyone who wants to help out and help make our community a more welcoming place to Latino immigrants to stop by El Centro. You really don't have to have an amazing level of Spanish to be involved. Everyone is appreciated. Thanks for listening. I am Molly Wagshall with El Centro.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Francis Sheets and Jonah Chester in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Michael Glapp.
Activate is produced by Lucy Shake from the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Chris Martin. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdane, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Leanne Murrows.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for KiteLine, a program amplifying the voices of those within Indiana's prison system, coming up next on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate.
You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a daily local news volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the daily local news Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.